Welcome back for another deep dive. This time, we're tackling those agile all-stars, scrum teams.
Always a hot topic, right?
Definitely. And our guidebook is The Professional Scrum Team. It's got some really interesting ideas about how we measure success, or if we even are. You've mentioned wanting to build a team that's both high-performing A&D, delivers value quickly, so.
Yeah, I'm hoping this book has some answers, because it's a tough balance.
For sure. But before we get too deep, for anyone who's new to this whole Scrum thing.
Right. Not everyone's a software whiz like us.
Exactly.
So imagine a team working in short bursts, constantly adapting, and they're always focused on actually delivering a usable chunk of their work at the end of each burst.
So it's more than just like writing code all day.
Way more. While it's started in software, the book makes it clear these principles can apply to, well, almost anything. Marketing, research, even product development.
Interesting. Now, the book jumps right into a common misconception. It questions whether a team's velocity, how much they're getting done, truly equals success. And I'll admit, I've fallen into that trap too, thinking more output always equals better results.
It's an easy trap. But the book argues that focusing solely on velocity can be, well, kind of dangerous. Have you seen any real-world consequences of this fixation on just churning out work?
Oh yeah, I've seen it lead to like inflated estimates. Oh. People feel pressured to work at this crazy pace, so they pad their time estimates to protect themselves. Suddenly, it's not about delivering real value, it's just hitting those arbitrary velocity targets.
A numbers game, not exactly inspiring.
Right, it becomes a game instead of, you know, actually achieving something meaningful.
The book calls these vanity metrics. Velocity might look good on a report, but it doesn't actually show the impact of the team's work.
Makes sense. So if velocity isn't the be-all and end-all, what is?
The book makes a strong argument for a shared vision. Imagine a team that doesn't really understand the product they're building or the problem they're supposed to solve. They could be working incredibly fast, but...
Yeah, like a ship with no rudder, right?
Exactly. Lots of speed, but no clear direction. So how do you build this shared vision? It all starts with the why.
The why.
Why are we doing this? What value does this bring to the users? Those answers should be crystal clear to every single person on the team.
Okay, so a strong vision keeps the team on track. Helps them decide what's important.
Exactly. It's their guiding star. And the book even gives a practical tip. Break those big, overwhelming objectives down into smaller, intermediate goals.
So instead of one giant mountain to climb,
you have these stepping stones, little wins along the way. Helps you stay focused and motivated.
I like that. So listener, before you get lost in the how, make sure you and your team are crystal clear on the what. What do you want to achieve? Now, speaking of making smart choices, the book introduces this really intriguing concept. The last responsible moment.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. This is about making strategic decisions, even when there's a ton of uncertainty. Basically, you delay making the decision until the last possible moment when you have the most information, but not so late that you miss out on opportunities.
So it's about finding that sweet spot, right?
Right. And the book introduces the learning window to help with this. It's that time between realizing you need to make a decision and that last responsible moment.
So instead of just waiting, you're actively using that time to learn everything you can.
Exactly. Gathering insights, doing research, even running experiments to test your assumptions.
The more you know, the better the decision, right?
Right. Now, let's say you need to choose a new technology for your project.
Okay, that's a good one. Lots of options out there.
So first, what info is absolutely essential to make that call? Maybe understanding each tech's pros and cons, the costs, if it'll work with your current systems. Even things like user preferences matter.
Okay, so you make a list of those information gaps, then actively work to fill them before the deadline.
Exactly. A structured approach like this, well, it just leads to better results. Now, moving on, another key to successful Scrum, delivering work that's actually ready to use.
Not just, like, halfway done.
Nope. The book calls it a releasable product increment at the end of each sprint.
This is definitely different from that old waterfall model where testing was saved till the very end.
Oh, yeah. Those were the days. Delay after delay, surprise after surprise. This releasable mindset is a driving force behind DevOps, too.
Oh, right, with all that continuous integration and delivery stuff.
Exactly. But to really grasp it, we got to define releasable. What does that actually mean?
Yeah, because that could be different for different teams, right?
For sure. So picture this. Each sprint ends with something tangible, something you could deliver to users if needed, maybe a new feature, a bug fix, or an improvement to an existing feature.
So it's more than checking off tasks. It's about, like, creating something valuable, ready to go live.
Exactly. always moving towards that state of readiness. Now, imagine a team that's always in this releasable state. How does that change how they work?
Sounds like it would take some serious collaboration skills, right?
It definitely does. And to achieve this level of performance, you need a cross-functional team. But before you tune out, because you've heard that buzzword a million times.
Trust me, I'm listening. Cross-functional teams, bring it on.
Okay, good. So it's simple. A cross-functional team has all the skills needed to take an idea from like a napkin sketch to a fully working product. No waiting around for someone else.
So instead of separate teams for design, coding, testing, and all that, you have one team that can handle it all.
You got it. The book has this example of a team that gets totally blocked because they need permission from another department just to set up a testing environment. Talk about a momentum killer.
Ugh, been there. So frustrating.
Right. But a cross-functional team, they can move much faster because they have all the expertise right there.
Like having all the right tools in your toolbox.
Yeah, exactly. Faster problem solving, a shared sense of ownership. It's a beautiful thing. But building this kind of team takes more than just like hiring a bunch of skilled people. It takes a shift in mindset, both for the team members and indeed the entire organization.
That's a great point, and something we should definitely explore further. Maybe after a quick break, we can dive deeper into that mindset shift and how to actually make those cross-functional teams work in the real world.
Sounds good to me.
We were talking about cross-functional teams before the break. Sounds awesome on paper, but I imagine it takes work to like break down those silos and get people collaborating effectively.
Oh, absolutely. It's not going to happen overnight. One big thing is empowering team members to own their work and make decisions, you know, without needing a manager breathing down their neck for every little thing.
So it's about moving away from that command and control style towards something more trusting.
Yeah, giving them more autonomy. The book calls it shifting from directing to leading. So instead of micromanaging every detail, leaders focus on setting those clear goals, getting roadblocks out of the team's way, and just creating a space where people feel safe to try things out and, you know, maybe even fail sometimes.
So are there examples of how leaders can actually do that, make that shift?
The book really emphasizes transparency and open communication. Leaders have to be clear about the team's goals, why they're making certain decisions, and be open to feedback from everyone. And it's not just about talking, it's also about giving the team the resources and support they need. But then you got to step back and trust them to figure things out.
It sounds like a tightrope walk, finding that balance between giving guidance and letting them run with it.
It is, and it takes a lot of trust on both sides. But when it works, it's incredibly empowering, both for the team and the leader.
Before the break, we were also digging into the idea of a team being constantly releasable. This seems to tie in with those DevOps principles we mentioned.
Yeah, how does that connection work? Exactly. So this releasable mindset fits perfectly with DevOps practices like continuous integration and delivery. These practices are all about automating the development process. You want to make it as smooth and efficient as possible to get new features or bug fixes out to users.
So instead of waiting for this big formal release process,
it's constant, integrating, testing, basically ready to go live at any moment.
Which also means you catch errors way earlier when they're easier and cheaper to fix.
Exactly. You're not waiting weeks or months to see how a new feature performs. You're getting that feedback almost instantly.
Much less stressful, I imagine.
Yeah.
And the book mentions this culture of continual experimentation and learning within DevOps. What does that actually look like day to day?
It means being okay with trying new things, different tools, different processes, and learning from your successes and failures.
So not just sticking to the plan no matter what. You're flexible. You adapt based on what you learn along the way.
Right. This goes back to that idea of embracing failure. In a DevOps environment, failures aren't something to be punished or hidden. They're like valuable data points.
Interesting. So it's more about creating a safe space to experiment. You know, not every experiment's going to be a home run.
Exactly. It's okay to try things and have them not work out. Now, while we're talking about positive team environments, let's talk about the book's insights on conflict resolution. Because let's face it, disagreements are going to happen, especially when you have passionate people working together.
It's inevitable. So how do you handle those conflicts effectively?
It starts with open and honest communication. People need to feel comfortable speaking their minds, sharing concerns, without worrying they'll be judged or, you know, punished for it.
And that takes good listening skills too, right?
Yeah.
Really understanding where the other person is coming from.
Huge. Even if you disagree with them completely, the book has some really practical tips for having those tough conversations.
I'm all ears. What are some of the key takeaways?
One is to stick to the facts. Don't make it personal. It's easy to get emotional, but try to keep things objective, focused on the actual problem.
So instead of saying you always miss deadlines, you might say,
hey, we've noticed some delays with these specific tasks. What's going on there?
Yeah, much better. Less accusatory.
The book also talks about finding common ground. Even when it feels like everyone's at odds, there are usually some areas of agreement.
So starting from that shared understanding can make the whole conversation more productive.
Exactly. And it reminds everyone that you're all on the same team, working towards the same goal, even if you have different ideas on how to get there.
Now, the book also mentions consensus decision making. It sounds like an alternative to traditional voting or just compromising until everyone's kind of unhappy.
Yeah, it's more collaborative. The team works together to find a solution that everyone can live with, even if it's not everyone's absolute favorite.
So it's not about one person winning the argument.
Right. And this approach can be really empowering for team members because everyone has a say. Everyone feels like their opinion matters.
Okay, I like that. And speaking of empowerment, let's circle back to the book's emphasis on self-organizing teams. I feel like that's a big part of the Scrum philosophy.
Yeah, the book argues that self-organizing teams are more engaged, more productive, and ultimately more successful. But it's not easy to create that kind of team. It requires a shift in mindset, both for the team members themselves and for the entire organization.
So what makes a team self-organizing? What are some of those key traits?
Well, they understand the big picture, the goals, and how their work fits in. They have the freedom to make decisions about how they work, who does what, and they all feel a sense of responsibility for the outcome.
Which all boils down to trust, right?
Big time. And often it means changing the entire company culture. We've covered so much in this deep dive, the importance of vision, building those cross-functional teams, navigating those tricky conflicts. But there's one big piece of the puzzle we haven't talked about yet, measuring success.
That's a good point. How do we know if all this effort is actually paying off? And how do we use data to keep getting better? Let's tackle that next.
Let's do it.
Okay, so we've talked about vision, cross-functional teams, even how to handle those inevitable conflicts. But now, the big question, how do we actually measure success with Scrum? Is it just about checking things off a to-do list?
Not even close. The book pushes us to look beyond those vanity metrics, you know, the ones that look good on paper but don't tell the whole story.
You like velocity. Just because a team's cranking out a ton of work doesn't mean they're actually delivering value.
Exactly. We need metrics that show the real impact of what a team's doing. And the book introduces this framework called key value areas, or KVAs.
Oh, KVAs. Okay, I'm listening. What are these key areas all about?
There are four main ones: current value, unrealized value, ability to innovate, and time to market. Each one kind of looks at success from a different angle.
All right, let's break them down. What's current value exactly?
Think of it as the value your product is providing to users right now. Are you actually meeting their needs? This is where you'd look at things like customer satisfaction scores, revenue generated, even just the number of active users.
So it's about the tangible impact you're having, not just lines of code or features shipped.
Exactly. Then there's unrealized value. This one's about potential. What value could you be delivering if you were truly meeting all your user needs?
Ah, so it's about finding those gaps, those opportunities to do even better.
Right. Next, you've got ability to innovate. This is all about how well a team adapts to change and comes up with new stuff.
Especially important in today's world, right? Everything's changing so fast.
It's essential. If you're not innovating, you're falling behind. And last but not least, there's time to market. How quickly can your team get something new, a feature, a product into the hands of users?
Speed is key in so many industries. Being first can be a huge advantage.
And even if you're not racing to be first, getting value to users faster is always a win.
So these KVAs, taken together, paint a much bigger picture than just velocity. It's a more sophisticated way to look at success, for sure.
They really force you to think, are you delivering value? Are you innovating? Are you leaving potential on the table?
Good questions.
Yep.
Does the book actually give specific metrics for each KVA?
It gives examples, but the big takeaway is choose the metrics that really matter for your specific goals and your specific situation. There's no magic formula.
Makes sense. You wouldn't measure a mobile game team the same way you'd measure, say, an enterprise software team.
Exactly. Each team's got to figure out what's most important to them and then track those metrics like a hawk. But it's not enough to just measure stuff. We have to use that data to actually get better.
Yeah, it's like having a speedometer in your car but never adjusting your speed based on what it's telling you.
Great analogy. The book talks about creating a closed loop system. You set a goal, figure out how you think you'll achieve it, try it out, see what happens, and then use those learnings to adjust your approach.
A scientific approach to teamwork, huh?
It is. Applying that same rigor and discipline to how we build things and how we work together. And a big part of that is the sprint retrospective, right?
Oh, yeah. That dedicated time at the end of each sprint to look back at what worked, what didn't, and how to improve.
Exactly. It's a chance for the team to be totally honest with each other and figure out concrete actions to take forward. Not just complaining, but actually solving problems.
And to make those retrospectives really work, you need an environment where people feel safe to speak up.
Right.
Even when they have criticisms.
Absolutely. Psychological safety is key. No one should be afraid to share their thoughts or admit when they've messed up. So, listener, think about your team's retrospectives. Are they truly productive? Are you coming out of them with actionable takeaways?
Because continuous improvement is a journey, right? It's not a destination. You can always get better.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, the professional Scrum team has given us a ton to think about. We've challenged some assumptions, explored a more holistic approach to teamwork. It's been quite a journey.
Scrum provides a framework, but the real magic comes from the team. They're the ones who take these principles and make them work in their unique situation.
So keep experimenting, keep learning, and keep building those amazing Scrum teams. Hopefully this deep dive has given you some fuel for your own Scrum journey. Until next time, keep learning, keep growing, and keep diving deep.